This is On Design, Monocle's weekly look at the best in architecture, craft, furniture, and fashion. I'm Nick Manise, filling in for Nolan Giles. The design industry, from architects to landscape designers, spends a lot of time talking about how to make their buildings and civic spaces green and more eco-friendly. On today's show, we check in with a European company offering a sustainable alternative to concrete. We'll also host a roundtable on landscape architecture and urban reforestation. And, to cap it all off, we'll find out how an Australian city is regenerating existing ecosystems. Those tales of green goodness and more are coming up right here on Design. Do stay tuned. Togo-born Swiss-based Neandli Landreau is a co-founder of Oxara, a company whose pioneering product is a mineral mixture that can be added to construction waste to form a sustainable concrete. The result? Well, it's a building material that is more than 90% less harmful to the planet than traditional concrete, and up to 20% cheaper. Currently pitching the material to architects, developers, and construction companies, we caught up with Landreau after his talk at the Monocle Chiefs Conference in St. Moritz last week.
If you take the case of Switzerland, one good thing is that if you are demolishing your building, there is a process to recycle it. But oftentimes, after the recycling, it's just landfilled. What we are doing is more use this recycled material or the excavation material that you have on site. Therefore, you don't have to transport it to the landfill anymore. Second, as our process use similar concrete infrastructure and processes, therefore, the way of using it to build with it will be similar as if you are building with concrete. So you will have, in terms of practicality, no change in how you will be building. It's just you need to be mindful in terms of what kind of performance you want to achieve, as the material performance will change depending on the waste that you have on the site. Construction waste that is available, just to give some specific here, 35 million tons exist in Switzerland each year, that is landfill. So it's a massive amount. And in Europe, we are talking about 600 million tons per year. So this abundant material, basically you can find it everywhere. And our key mineral that we add is also like a natural material. It's almost in all the European countries, in all the Asian, African countries, American countries. So our production can be localized as you are using also local waste. So everything can be decentralized and you can have lower impact on your whole building material. It's really interesting question, the durability and the performance of the material for the long run. For Oxara, we need to create trust and create a lot of proof of concept, tangible proof of concept that people can go and touch and feel each time so that it gives them a confidence in using their material. But for the long-term durability, we still need to do more tests in the laboratory to be able to confirm what will be the performance of this material in the couple of years. However, we are confident that the performance will not that much degrade as we know existing building technology, how it performs in the future. We need hard proof that, yeah, it could work, which is really key to convince developer or like a owner in building with this material, because he doesn't want to just build in 2 years' time have something that is crumbling down. And for that aspect, we are looking into implementing our technology first and foremost in the indoor application, where you don't have so much constraint on the material. So it could be like self-supporting wall element that are like either separating between your living room or your bedroom and things like this. We mostly try to avoid the confusion in the mind of people or to have a specific connotation to this material. We don't want it to be seen as material for the poor because it's kind of cheaper, but a material that can help solve problems in the global south and in the global west as well. So our advantage of being here in Switzerland and working here and try to implement it here is the infrastructure, the knowledge, and all the material that is available at our disposal to do most of these tests that are key in order to bring the material to the market to commercialize it. Meanwhile, we are also pushing projects in Africa. For instance, in Rwanda, we are discussing projects in Kenya, for instance, and also, of course, in my home country, in Togo. We have different layers of influencers that we are trying to reach. The first one are architects that are doing the design. They need to hear about our product and want to test it or use it on the project. For instance, today we are talking about for the own lecture with Norman Foster video. Will be really a huge showcase for us to have a famous architect who uses this technology in his building. But of course, we are trying also to connect with the construction companies because they are the one that will be building our ClinCrete at the end, and also the mason who will be implementing it on the site. So we are trying to connect with the different stakeholders on the construction chain.
Our thanks to Nianli Landro. He was speaking to Monocle's design editor and this show's regular host, Nolan Giles. Now, from our buildings to the spaces in between them. Carefully designed and managed urban landscapes and greenery can help improve our health whilst also providing important ecosystem services. To better understand how this is possible, I'm now joined by two experts well-versed on the matter. First, Mick Young Kim, founder of her eponymous design practice and fellow of the American Society of Landscape Architects. Kim's well known for creating parks, plazas and gardens that restore both nature and a person's sense of calm. And second, Elise Van Midlem, founder of Sugi, a reforestation project that works with local communities to turn vacant and forgotten patches of land into dense forests in only a matter of years. Mick Young, we'll start with you. Your studio has, over the last 15 years, particularly with your work on clinical and healthcare projects like the Boston Children's Hospital, you've really focused on creating restorative spaces using landscape and greenery rather than, say, architecture to improve the public's health. Could you tell us a little bit about this work and why it's become so important in recent years?
There's a real clear scientific basis for that understanding of how the natural world normalizes the circuitry of our brain function, our blood flow, our bodies. And, you know, we all know this. We all know this when we enter the natural world, we go to the beach or something, that we get a sense of well-being that often happens quite immediately. It transforms us. But I think today we live in sort of an upside-down world, right? This year in 2020. With the pandemic and here in the U.S., and I know in Europe, there have been just these very large rallies and protests calling for racial justice. And so the landscape has become such a vital place. It's a place where people's voices are heard, but also as designers, it's our job to make it a place where not only do they feel safe, but it's designed with some of the intentions, that some of the knowledge that we've developed from the design of these kind of clinical spaces. So I'd say like there's this really interesting inversion. Usually in the past, ever since I was a child here in the U.S., I remember when something really terrible was happening, people would say, you know, stay inside, stay sequestered inside, lock the doors, close the windows. But now there's a kind of inversion where people are going outside for refuge and they're gravitating towards these places.
So Mick Young, as we gravitate or spend more time outdoors, and if we look at urban landscapes, perhaps as a series of spaces between buildings, is there something to be said about, say, linking up several green spaces rather than just having them as standalones? Is there a formula to that?
So, you know, there isn't really a formula. It's a process because every city, every neighborhood is different. It's not just a collection of individual buildings, but it is a tapestry of these kind of green spaces. The other interesting thing that's happening here in the U.S. is that as these cities have sort of hunkered down, the tapestry of these green spaces have expanded to roadways, sidewalks, riverfronts, you know. So this idea of how we can build a city, not just as an understanding of a collection of objects, i.e. buildings, but also, and not just the kind of leftover spaces after you've laid in all the roads, but how do you create a city where it's a complete fabric? And I think that's something that's very interesting to us.
And I think that's a really nice point to, I guess, bring Elise into the discussion. I mean, Elise, you use the Miyawaki method, which for the uninitiated, and I'll be honest, I was one until relatively recently, it's essentially a preparation and planting method that sees rapid growth of plant life. And you use this to rewild landscapes. You know, to me, it sort of seems that your work is all about finding these forgotten spaces where you can plant and help create and introduce biodiversity to urban landscapes. I guess with this in mind, is there anything that you want to add to Mick Young's point?
So first of all, another point too, it's what Mick Young said, is that it's true that this is the time to review certain spaces, waterways, parking lots, abandoned sites, landfills. We can transform these spaces, all of them, into ideal habitats for birds to nest, for fruits to grow, for fresh air, and also just for the magic of nature to thrive. It's a proposition I really believe in strongly, but what does it mean at first hand, the return of biodiversity? Well, when we create those ultra-dense biodiverse forests with native species only, we bring in communities. Kids in the school, we love to make these forests in schools. We love to make them in very accessible places. When we bring people together, it starts there, actually, the education around biodiversity, because we start with the soil. We don't put a tree in the ground just like that. We first start with working the soil, and then we plant on 1 square meter, 10 square feet, 3 to 5 trees. And by planting so dense in shrub, subtree, tree, and canopy, we allow for the fungal network to come back very quickly. And only this already, it's all these articles, books that are coming out right now about get dirty and, you know, reconnect with nature. And how important it is actually to smell the forest floor, to feel it, to see the decaying leaves, to see the miscellaneous network come back, the mushrooms. And then as soon as the trees grow, because they're so dense, birds can nest. They can really hide in there. So you can have an enormous amount of pollinators that come back, butterflies. I always, in a way, think of these forests, these urban pocket forests, if you want. For next generations, it could be educational and healing sites, because it's a restoration of native species.
I mean, we're talking here about essentially creating new ecosystems in our cities, or at least reintroducing ones that have been gone for a long time to help create restorative landscapes. To do this, what factors, I mean, and including but also moving beyond just planting, what factors need to be considered?
So Elise brought this up. You know, I think every year, with the rise in global temperature, you know, the kind of zones of planting transform. And it's so incremental in certain ways that we're not noticing here, you know. And it's our job as landscape architects to remind everybody, how do we future-proof this landscape that we're designing to think about in 2060? Not only is it about resiliency and water and managing stormwater with global warming, but it's also understanding what kind of planting can survive this incremental transformation as the earth heats up. You know, I think also the idea of introducing urban ecosystems, new nature-based urban ecosystems and biomes into the city in a kind of maybe in a more miniaturized form is something that is more and more part of the work that we're doing. We're very interested in. So it goes back to what was this place and where does it want to go to in the future? And how do we understand where water is moving through? I mean, water is such an important piece of working on any city from Boston to New York to Houston to San Francisco and Miami, all these places. There's a real consideration of how do you collect stormwater? How do you manage it? How do you manage for these extreme storms that are coming through? Landscape architects are addressing the kind of pressing ecological issues that face us today. But I really believe that they're intricately tied to the kind of human health and well-being component. that the two are kind of inseparable, particularly when you work in these kind of urban environments.
I think we've sort of nicely established the importance of rewilding and introducing greenery in our urban landscapes, and I guess also touched on how other environmental systems need to be incorporated. But I'm curious, you know, if you can perhaps run us through a project, Mick Young, that brings all these facets together. I mean, I know you've worked on Seoul's famous river corridor. I mean, we've featured that in Monocle magazine ourselves. You know, you transformed a sewer under a highway into a natural drainage system that helps to manage runoff and rainfall in the city. Could you talk us through that?
When you look online at this project, it's called the Chungay River, you can see that at times, particularly in the summer when they have monsoon storms, that entire wall that holds this kind of lower stream basin is full all the way up. And so the river acts and the design acts in a kind of dual fashion. During most of the year, it improves air quality. It's been shown to, it has improved air quality. It has reduced heat island effect. It's brought the water quality to a class 2 level and reintroduced hundreds of new species of birds and fish. So the city actually did this to create this new urban ecosystem. And then during the summer months when they get torrential rainstorms, it becomes a protective device to make the city more resilient. When you look at the city in that area before they built this, essentially a stormwater basin that allows for water to slowly percolate out, you would see that the roadways were just flooded and the city was brought to a standstill.
And finally, Elise, I mean, you worked on, in some ways, a similar project in Beirut in Lebanon, where you transformed a landfill into a thriving native forest. Could you tell us a little bit more about that project? And again, not only how it greens the city in sight, but also how it offers perhaps other benefits to the people living there.
I think just also point to go back to Mikyung, because it's so true that the interventions, I feel, you do and that we all try to aim at with a work is really bring back that level of health and economic vitality and climate resilience of cities. And it's not always easy. Beirut is definitely a very good example. It's where everything started for us, where Sugi launched. Imagine a city that was literally built upon a forest and a beautiful riverbed would flow right into the city. Today they have the connection between nature and human has been almost for 80-90% erased. Certainly, they have gone through other important events throughout their past 20, 30, 40 years that nature was not an important topic. Now, my friend Adib, he's an architect, studied biomimicry, but also an environmentalist. And when I said to him, Adib, let's do forest done by the Miyawaki method in Beirut, he was like, let's do this right away. Just already to go into the municipalities, find the plot and really tell you what, we found a landfill. We took out so much plastic, bombshells, tires, liters and liters. Once that was done and we brought back the natural ingredients to the soil, such as, you know, mushroom compost, hay and husk, that forest now is 1 year old and it's already making a difference. Not only like socially, but also like ecologically. For some certain reason or the other, they had enormous rainfalls. And exactly like Mick Young says, the stormwater mitigation, the retention is phenomenal. And it's also very interesting how all the streets were flooding and our forest was in a perfect state. So then it's where you see like we need way more sinks or places where the water actually can seep through and go and be retained. So that's one thing. And I think that the return of biodiversity has been really visible, meaning like this year, only in 1 year forest, we had these birds' nests. We see many more butterflies. We have a birds watcher from Lebanon that comes and sees it when native birds are returning. And so it's been a project that I call it a resilience forest. You know, we planted one part in May last year, but we planted another part during the revolution. Now they had the blast and we're planting the next part in November in another forest.
My thanks to Elise Van Midlem and Mick Young Kim. Now, before we head to our final item, here's this week's key design events and releases that you can't miss. And the most important industry news too. from Monocle's very own Maylee Evans.
Thanks, Nick. First to the United States, where the Los Angeles County Museum of Art has unveiled plans and renderings that show the shape of the museum's new buildings, the David Geffen Galleries, for the first time. Designed by Pritzker Prize-winning Swiss architect Peter Zumthor, the new addition features an elevated exhibition floor which rests on seven independent pavilions, each with singular programs including a restaurant, gift shop, gallery, and 300-seat theatre. Next to Austria, where Vienna Design Week kicks off this Friday. Highlights include the Passion Sfiga project, which sees contemporary designers paired with traditional Viennese manufacturers, and the annual special exhibition, which focuses on the design practices of a different nation each year. 2020's edition will hone in on Swiss design and showcase the works of nine studios who are pioneering innovative products including adaptable typography, smart textiles, connected heating systems, functional sleepwear, and distinctive tableware. Whilst toilet talk shouldn't be encouraged, we do need to discuss the Tokyo Toilet Project, a collaboration involving the Nippon Foundation and respected Japanese bathroom brand Toto. Involving the construction of 17 toilets across Shibuya, the campaign sees new restrooms built to the design of world-class architects. Its newest facility, unveiled last week, is by Pritzker Prize winner Tadao Ando. The Japanese architect's cylindrical louvered structure is worth a visit, even if you don't need to use the facilities. And finally, let's talk about sex. Specifically, the work of Australian design studio Frost Collective. Tasked by the New South Wales state government with raising public awareness around consent, its graphic and video campaign shows how good communication leads to better sex. And who doesn't want that? The work, characterised by the slogan "Yes plus yes equals yes," recently won a Good Design Australia Award. There's a serious topic at the heart of this campaign, of course, but also a lesson for graphic designers. Messaging must always be clear and instantly understandable. Back to you, Nick.
Thanks to Maylee Evans there, with some highlights from this week's design news. For more, visit our website and subscribe to our Monocle on Design newsletter, which hits inboxes every Wednesday. Finally, on today's show, we're hoping our roundtable has planted some seeds of curiosity and that you might be on the hunt for some great greening projects. Well, you need look no further than Brisbane. Recently, the Australian city unveiled a 20-year master plan for the rehabilitation of a long corridor of struggling native habitat, Oxley Creek. Local landscape architecture studio LAT27 are responsible for the project's delivery. Our Brisbane correspondent, Michaela Aitken, headed outdoors to find out more.
I'm standing on Ann Street. It's a major artery that slices through downtown Brisbane. You can definitely hear the traffic zooming past, and I hedge bets that you can almost hear the swish of suits and banking of bills. That signifies that I'm really in the thick of the state capital's economic engine room. But despite this audio onslaught of the modern-day hustle bustle that you can hear surrounding me, Brisbane really is quite a special place to be.
There's a beautiful, benign climate, abundant and lush native greenery, and an active willingness from local government, urban planners, and landscape architects to harness both of these factors and increase the urban population's access to green spaces. And while there's manicured urban parks and architecturally designed river walks aplenty, Brisbane's population can also get a wilder biophilic fix by taking a short drive to the outer suburbs. We've travelled just 25 minutes from the city centre to Oxley Creek. This is where Brisbane City Council, designers and the community are working together to restore a 20-kilometre-long corridor of waterways and surrounding bushland.
So we're sitting down by Oxley Creek at Oxley Creek Common. This is a really well-loved community space.
I'm joined by senior landscape architect Georgina Pratton from LAT Studios. Along with the team from Oxley Creek Transformation, Georgina and her LAT27 colleagues built a master plan for this wild patch of greenery back in 2018.
A significant part was that it was robust. from an environmental and social perspective. So we looked at Indigenous cultural heritage, hydrological values, ecological and habitat values, and of course social values. We tried to pull all that together, as well as some in-depth community engagement and stakeholder engagement, to really create a master plan that was representative of what is and what can be, but had, I guess, tangible outcomes that the community could really engage with.
Historically, Brisbaneites have turned their backs to the creeks and rivers, treating them as industrial transportation nodes rather than a backdrop for nature and recreation. Happily, this mentality has gone through an astronomical shift in recent years, a fact that's supported by the equivalent investment of nearly 62 million euro from City Hall for this Oxley Creek project alone. Importantly, though, Oxley Creek's master plan is a long game approach, a 20-year approach, in fact.
Key design outcomes really were to create a 20-kilometre linear walking and cycling trail. Obviously, that's a really long-term plan. There's a lot of things that have to happen in the interim.
Smartly, the project deliverables have been broken down into incremental improvements. This helps ensure change is achievable, economically viable, and that design remains in touch with the ecological and social requirements of the community. An expansive team spanning government and multiple landscape architecture firms are working towards elevating the green corridor so that it becomes one of the city's key lifestyle and leisure destinations.
We had some priority projects that fell out of it, one of which has just been recently opened down at Larapinta. It's an adventure playground, and getting the kids involved, they've got a little bush rangers program, so that's pretty cool. Oxley Creek Common is one, so we're sitting here just supporting the existing initiatives and increasing habitat diversity. Open bushlands are really critical to birds, so you know, you want to find a balance.
The Oxley Creek Transformation Master Plan is a lesson in not forgetting about the green potential already sitting on your doorstep. Those spaces that often just need a little bit of love and an investment of ideas and intelligent long-term planning.
What is your favourite part about Oxley Creek?
The idea that you can create real change over a long period of time that benefits multiple people, whether they work in the area, live in the area, visit the area. That, to me, is a really satisfying outcome.
That's Georgina with her professional hat on. She and everyone on this project are proud of the biophilic benefits the Oxley Creek transformation will have for an increasingly crowded city. But I dug a little deeper and found out another reason for Georgina's excitement.
As a avid hiker, I cannot wait for 20 years' time when I can walk 30 kilometres along the corridor, or even better yet, keep walking all the way to Flinders Peak in Ipswich. I guess that's part of this creek, is that it's bigger than just Brisbane and it's bigger than just Oxley Creek transformation.
For Monocle, in Brisbane's brilliant great outdoors, I'm Michaela Aitken.
My thanks to Michaela Aitken there for that report. And sadly, that's all we have time for on today's show. Keen for more design stories? Well, listen to our 5-minute midweek sister show On Design Extra, which airs every Thursday. Today's episode was produced and edited by Maylee Evans, and thanks to research from Charlie Fillmore Court too. I'm Nick Manise. Thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.